What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson. Let's get this started.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This week, we're going to be interviewing Travis Statham, aka Hyper Carnivore. He's huge on Twitter and Reddit, pretty prolific researcher, and knows a lot about the carnivore movement. So we brought him on to talk about humans being classified as facultative carnivores, which pretty much just means we're designed to eat meat, we thrive on meat. The definition isn't really concerned about what we can eat, like how people classify us as omnivores because we can eat everything. It's more worried about what we should be eating, and that's meat, in our opinion at least. So we brought him on to talk about that. But first, a little check-in. Tom, how's your week been?
I'm feeling great. I know last time we did this podcast, I was just getting over being sick. I feel amazing right now. Not only did I finally finish Tripping Over the Truth, that book was such a roller coaster. I've never had my emotions just go from excited and happy and optimistic to wanting to punch my like windshield in my car or just cry because I was sad. I've never been that emotional since I've read like the Game of Thrones book. It was just crazy. And other than that, I'm on day 3 of a 4-day fast. The only reason I'm going to end it at 4 days is because of Valentine's Day. If it wasn't for that holiday, I'd probably go 5 or 6 days because I don't think I've ever felt this good, like this far into a fast before. Usually I'm just can't wait to get food into me. And like really right now, like I'm really in a deep level of ketosis, feeling absolutely amazing. I've had 3 really tough workouts so far this week. I already worked out today. After this podcast, I'm going to go home and work out some more. I don't know. I just got too much energy and just feel amazing.
Oh, yeah. Fasting's great, man. It really is.
It's been too long since I've done one. I forgot how good they feel.
Exactly. I said the same thing. I forget when I did mine a few days or a few weeks back, but the same thing. I was like, man, once you're in it, you realize, like, man, I should do this more often.
I've been going grocery shopping yesterday and today, just surrounded by food, and usually that's what does me in. Not even tempted or anything.
Bulletproof.
Yeah.
Good, man. That's good.
So, what's new with you?
Started a 12-week cut to summer. So, everyone out there trying to get their summer bods, I know it seems weird because it's cold and rainy outside, but now's the time to start. So, in about 12 weeks, it's going to be mid-May or so, and I'm going to be diced as shit, or at least that's the goal.
Well, use that cold weather to your advantage.
What, and go sit outside?
Yeah. That's great for helping you burn more fat.
Yeah, right.
Turn that white body fat into brown metabolically active fat.
Well, you know I still take ice cold showers. It's been so cold. I don't know if I told you this or not. It's been so cold. I let the water kind of hit my chest and my neck that I get brain freeze. Damn. Did I tell you that?
That's new.
Yeah, so I literally, that's like my cue to get out the shower because it's so damn cold. But yeah, so doing that, and so far so good. I'm 3 days in, and I'm already getting leaner. It's crazy, like, how fast my body's responding. And the last time I did this was in, like, October-ish, when I was dieting down for Thanksgiving. I'm starting now leaner than I was when I started back, or last year. So I'm really hoping this time, doing it for 12 weeks, I can do it a little more gradual. I'm not going to cut my calories low. I'm just going to manipulate my macros as far as percentage-wise. So right now, I'm 55% fat, 45% protein. I'm going to run that through February. And then when March rolls around, depending on if my body stops responding, I'll just switch that percentages to 50-50. And then if I need to go deeper, I will, increasing protein, decreasing fat, and just keep riding it out. But hopefully I don't need to go much more like high fat, low protein than high protein, low fat than I am now. Yeah, so far so good. I feel good. I'm not starving yet, so.
Yeah, I mean, once you start starving,
it's gonna suck. Work, yeah. It probably is, but right now I feel fine. And yeah, that's about it. It's all new to me. All right, everybody. So we have Travis Statham on the podcast today. He's also known as Hyper Carnivore on Twitter and over the internet. He's super knowledgeable about carnivore, and he follows a diet himself, a real huge advocate on the internet about it. So Travis, just want to know kind of what's your carnivore story. So how did you stumble on this diet?
Yeah, hey guys, thanks for having me on the podcast. I wanted to say this is kind of like TNT and T.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't even think of it until right now.
Yeah. And, so my story. So, after college, I read Good Calories, Bad Calories by Gary Tobbs. It was my first foray into nutrition. And the book simply astounded me. I was amazed at how much information it had and how much I really didn't know about nutrition before that. So I started a ketogenic diet, I guess, in 2012. And from the get-go, it was like, it was amazing. I felt really good. I lost 10 or 15 pounds. I was maybe like 170, 175 after college. And I'm like a tall, skinny guy. I'm like 6'2". And currently I'm around 150, 152. So I got down to maybe like 160 and kind of hovered around there in keto. And then over the following 5 or 6 years, I mean, I didn't forget about keto, but I went through all the motions of like, do I want to do this forever? Like I knew I felt better. I knew I looked better while doing keto, but the real question was like, do I give up beer? Do I give up junk food? Do I just enjoy my 20s as much as possible? And I went through periods where I wasn't on keto, and then I would rebound and come back to it and lose weight again. And so this happened over many years. And then like 2 years ago, I read The Case Against Sugar by Gary Tobbs, and it reinvigorated me. And I was like, wow, like I really need to stay on keto. Sugar is really toxic. There's just no reason to eat it. So I jumped back in, and around then I started posting quite often to Reddit. So there's a subreddit called Keto Science. And actually I was posting to R Keto, and I was finding like scientific articles on R Science and other various subreddits. And I was like, wow, R Keto must love all this stuff, you know, and I thought they would upvote it really big, like a lot. And actually, like, there was very little interest from the community for like scientific related articles. And then I looked deeper and I realized there was another subreddit called Keto Science. So I ended up starting to post all my links to Keto Science, and here is a community that actually understood the science behind it. There was knowledgeable posters, people that would respond. Sometimes I would just post articles that I knew were related to keto, but weren't like I didn't really know how to explain it like it's five, you know? So I was hoping like other people would kind of fill in those blanks for me. And I just didn't have the time to read like 20 or 30 page, you know, scientific articles every day. Mm-hmm. But over time, I asked one of the remaining Keto Science moderators if I could join the moderator team at Keto Science, because Keto Science works through a mod queue, so moderators have to approve posts before they get displayed. That way there's no like dumb questions being asked or like spam and whatnot. So I became a moderator, and then I changed the whole subreddit around to kind of allow a lot more content and have a lot more flair that's relevant to certain post topics. And I just became very knowledgeable about all things keto.
At this time, are you thinking about carnivore, or are you still just strictly in the keto box?
I was strictly in the keto box. I knew that like carnivores could exist because Gary Tobbs talks about Viljamar Stefansson a little bit in his book. But I always kind of, when I first read that, I was like, that's crazy. I don't want to be like the guy that eats only meat. And I didn't really know if it was healthy or not, and I kind of assumed that I needed fiber and I needed some kind of plants, but I didn't really know why. It's just kind of like a faith-based assumption.
You know, I thought the same way when Tyson told me he was going carnivore. This was, what, like 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. We were out at dinner, and I was just like, man, that sounds crazy. I was like, if you're going to do it, you got to at least eat, like, nose to tail. Make sure you're getting some organ meats, get some bone broth in so you're getting all your minerals and stuff. I thought that at first it sounded crazy too, but the more I've looked into it, it just makes a lot more sense than it ever has.
Yeah, it's been a wild year and a half or so. So while posting in Keto Science and whatnot, someone posted about R0 Carb, and I was like, what is this? So I went on this other subreddit called Zero Carb, and I found some links to YouTube, and there was a link for Sean Baker, and he was saying, hey, I'm running this N equals many study where I want people to try the carnivore diet and provide feedback using a website called trackwell.com and kind of create like our own anecdotes that could maybe be counted as science. You know, like anecdotal evidence is generally very subpar and everyone doubts it, but I felt like there wasn't really any other way that we could figure out whether the carnivore diet is actually good. So I saw that video a year and a half ago in August of 2017, I guess, and became a big fan of Sean Baker, watched all his stuff, listened to some podcasts, and then I tried out carnivore for, you know, like 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and then I'd like eat plants again. I was just basically testing the waters to see if it would work for me, and overall I felt like it was really good. And I also felt like it was kind of like the missing link in the keto sphere. Like, keto works as a fantastic metabolic process, right? That mm-hmm. helps your whole metabolic body, but it still left me wondering, like, how did humans evolve? What kind of plants do we actually need, like, in our diet? And I felt like the reliance on salads and green veggies and everything was kind of faith-based. Like, we all were doing it because we all just knew it was healthy. But in the same, you know, respect, you also knew that, you know, carbs were healthy for 20 years of your life. And you thought you knew all this information, and in retrospect, you really didn't know anything.
When you realize that, it's such a huge revelation. You're like, man, I didn't know shit.
I know way more than I did 10 years ago, and I still think I know less now. Like, it's just crazy. Every time I read a book, I just feel dumber because I just have so many more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard you're rereading all your books from last year.
I'm trying to, man. Yeah.
It's funny that you bring up good calories, bad calories. Tyson's trying to get through that one for the second time right now. I got through it once, and I was like, that's enough. It's too long.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read it, and then I was going to, like, not read Why We Get Fat, his follow-up to it. And then I ended up reading that, and then I read The Case Against Sugar. And I think Gary's almost done with his, like, fourth book. I think it's about doctors and low-carb, but I'm not really sure.
Oh, so he's switching it up a little bit? Because, I mean, every book's just been sugar's like, bad.
Yeah.
Well, like, sugar bad is, like, a key point, but... Yeah. I think he wants to understand how doctors are using low carb in their clinics and whether, you know, it should be something that people should do. I'm excited for whatever Gary writes.
Gary Calves is an impressive human being. Like, seriously, the research he does is, it's daunting just to read his books, let alone know all the shit he did to get that information.
Yeah, it's kind of insane that he put in that much work just on good calories, bad calories, and then he keeps doing it over and over and over again. Like, he's looking through so much research. Thank God he's doing it, because I don't know who else is willing to put in that type of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've put in a lot of work over the last year to write wikis and kind of update my knowledge myself. Because I'm one of those guys that link everything, and I like to kind of just create information dumps, like, full of information, so that people can make up their own mind, you know?
You know, when you went carnivore initially, did you follow, like, Sean Baker's advice and stick with mainly red meats, or did you kind of find that out yourself?
Yeah, mostly. I didn't eat a ton of chicken as it was. Yeah, I mean, I was already pretty meat-based, like, ketogenic, so I knew, you know, I cooked a lot of steaks and burgers, and would eat lamb whenever I could find it, and I've always really liked red meat. I think over my evolution as, like, an early carnivore, I did realize, like, yeah, I shouldn't have as much chicken and kind of cut out, like, bad farmed fish and whatnot. But for the most part, yeah, I just knew that, like, red meat was good enough, or probably the best.
Yeah, no, that's what I stick with. We both pretty much stick to mainly red meat.
Red meat and eggs, like, and the eggs. Two staples of my diet. I buy a lot of uncured bacon, too, just the cooked stuff and the bacon fat, because it makes everything taste better.
It does.
Yeah. So what's your diet looking like now? What's, like, a typical day of eating for you?
So I work in New York City, and I commute into an office, and I never have breakfast. So I usually wake up around 8 or 9 a.m., commute in, get into work around 10, and then I'll have lunch between noon and 1. I usually walk around the area here, and I'll go to, like, a burger joint or, like a lamb kebab place, like a hot deli, you know, where they have, like, pre-made, like, pastrami and various meats. I've also gone to McDonald's a lot and just gotten patties or Wendy's.
So you don't consider the carnivore diet that restrictive, then? You find ways to still be social and still eat out?
Yeah. I don't really think it's that restrictive. I think it just comes down to having an iron will when you're in social situations, so that you can say, no, I'm not going to eat it. No, I don't want it. Thank you. I'm pretty open about my diet, so I kind of like generating a little controversy, so...
I know, I see what you post on Twitter, bro. You go at some people sometimes, man. It's funny.
Yeah, I do. It's fun. It's like an advocacy platform, but I'm out there to try and question people's assumptions and see what they really believe or the reasons they believe it. So yeah, so lunch, I get like a meal around the office. I usually spend $10 to $15 on lunch. Like, it's not cheap, but I eat a giant meal of about a pound of meat. I might have like four or five burger patties, or at like the weigh-in places, I'll get like a pound or 1.3 pounds. Yeah, so, like, I know I need about a pound of fatty meat for lunch. And then for dinner, I cook a lot, and my girlfriend also does the carnivore diet, so it's pretty easy at home. We might go to, like, the local, like, lamb kebab place and just get lamb only. But we go to, like, two or three different grocery stores and also Costco, get ground beef, steaks like ribeyes and New York strip. Sometimes I do slow cooker meals like chuck steak or corned beef, or like pork butt or pork shoulder. Sometimes I'll do fish like salmon or mahi mahi or whatever kind of is on sale.
Has your girlfriend been doing it as long as you, or she noticed your change and decided to adopt it?
Yeah, so she did keto right around when I met her, and she lost some weight and has basically stuck to it since. Originally, she didn't really want to be as extreme as me, and she was like, oh yeah, I'm still going to eat veggies, or she'll claim to other people like, yeah, she'll still eat veggies, but in reality, we eat very little plants.
You know what? I can relate to that. My wife... she's pretty much full carnivore now because she lives with a guy who only eats meat and only talks about the benefits of meat all the time. So I pretty much just broke her down over the last like 10 years, and now all she eats is meat too.
Yeah, I think one of the partners kind of does that, and then the other person kind of like fits their lifestyle into it. Like, I wouldn't mind if she was cooking vegetables and stuff, but it just adds like a lot of extra work. You gotta cook them fresh, and it adds like more time, and then you have to clean more pots and pans. You know, I've been pretty happy with how our diet works and how we kind of work as a team. Like, sometimes I'll cook, sometimes she cooks. She likes making kind of like wild carnivore-esque meals, like egg loaves and stuff. She's
What's an egg loaf?
Is that like ground beef and egg?
She'll use cream cheese and then like blend it in with eggs and then bake it, and it like rises a little bit, and it's just super tasty.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, I've heard of that just by a different name, but yeah, that does sound good.
Or she'll like whip like heavy cream and then maybe add like slight flavorings to it. So we kind of we have some desserts here and there, but they're pretty much carnivore with like maybe like fake sugar added. I'm pretty open about having diet soda or like a sugar-free Red Bull from time to time. I don't have it all the time, but I'm not like opposed to it. I don't like mind having them. I think mostly that is like if you have diet soda, you now like have tasted sweetness and now you want more sweetness. But I'm so dedicated to it, I'm not gonna cheat.
Yeah, like you said, at the end of the day, it's like a willpower game. If you have that iron will, then you can do those things. You don't have to really worry about it.
Right. And I think the iron will has evolved for me because I'm so invested in the science and I really want to kind of stay true to my word. I know the science, like why would I cheat, right? Like,
no, exactly. Yeah. And honestly, just getting into that, that's why earlier you said you do these huge information dumps. And I know you did one for why you believe humans should be classified or at least considered as facultative carnivores, which pretty much just means we should be eating meat. I saw you put so much information online. Like, what made you come to that? Like, you just collected so much information about that.
Yeah, so facultative carnivory is a class of animals. So animals can be herbivores, omnivores, or carnivores. And generally, like, we know, like, ruminants, like cows and sheep, ferment plant matter in their guts, and then they create, like, they feed a population of bacteria, and then they digest, basically, the bacteria as animal protein. So the bacteria make fat and protein, and then the herbivore can digest those bacterial products and use it for its own energy. Actually, like, herbivores are kind of on a high-fat diet, even though they mainly eat cellulose. Carnivores eat herbivores, right? So your carnivores are like lions and wolves and whales and stuff. There's like an interesting intersection, like, what do you call the animals that eat both plants and animals? And do they require both of these to live, or do they like thrive on one or the other? So probably the most famous omnivore are bears. We know they like eat fish, or they'll hunt ruminants out in the wild, but then they will eat lots of berries and plants basically to fatten up before winter, before hibernating. That's like a common omnivore. The question is, if we eat meat and we find that meat has like all these essential nutrients you need, like DHA, vitamin B12, and all these fats, and we know like protein is more bioavailable in meats. The question is, should we eat animals and then add in plants, or are we good enough with just animals? So other carnivores out there are just fine eating only animals. That said, some carnivores that we very much know they have evolved to fill their ecological niche with, you know, to be the best hunter in that location. Like a crocodile is like, you know, the apex predator in the river, and the wolf is the apex predator on the prairie, and the lion is apex predator on the savannah. Makes you wonder, like, these animals became carnivores, but they also will sometimes eat small amounts of plants. So, like, a crocodile might eat some plants in the water, like, to munch on. I'm not really sure why they do that, but they do. But we wouldn't want to say, like, oh, they're omnivores, right? Like, it doesn't really help us, like, think about animals if we're saying, like, everything is an omnivore. Like, you can feed deer meat. You know, like, in Iceland, they feed fish to horses sometimes in the winter when there's no grains to eat or no grass. So animals, like, generally most animals can be omnivorous. But, like, we know herbivores are really meant to eat plants and carnivores are meant to eat animals. So it brings up, like, if we're just calling ourselves omnivores, is that, like, a good enough definition? And does it really tell us anything about ourselves? And my question, I guess, or, like, the last year has been, well, if humans have evolved certain anatomical features that are best for hunting and then eating meat, does that mean that we're supposed to eat mainly meat, only meat, or like a mix of plants and animals and just kind of keep the omnivore label kind of very vague? And I think now that humans basically will thrive and have their best health when eating only animal products. And I've many reasons for this, but the problem is it's kind of like a brand new idea, I think, in kind of like the sciences, and most people haven't really, like, thought about this. So, like if you look up anthropology, you know, they'll say that meat eating is really important to humans, but then they'll also say, like, starches and eating plants is important too. So the question is, why didn't anthropologists, like, wonder or put the hypothesis forward that maybe humans are just meat eaters and would only resort to plants when in, like, a starving situation?
Yeah, because Stephenson, you talked about him earlier, he's a author of The Fat of the Land and a few other books. Him and I think one of his buddies pretty much lived in a hospital for a year and ate only meat. Like, these studies have been done, and for whatever reason, they kind of died with them.
Yeah, yeah. So, I can talk a bit about that study. That study was in Bellevue Hospital in New York City in 1929. And when he started it, all the nutritionists and doctors at, like, the hospital ward were pretty much taking bets on when he would die. So, Stephenson lived in the Arctic for about 10 years, and over the 10 years, there was like a culmination, I guess, of 5 years of pure carnivory. So he lived with the Eskimos. They would hunt for seals and walrus during certain periods of the year. Other periods, they would only fish, and they would only eat fish. And in other parts of the year, they would eat caribou. So they had like a varied diet, but it was a varied diet with like an annual cycle. And they weren't adding vegetable matter at all at any point, and they didn't seek it out basically. And they would live on like one animal product for several months in a row and then switch based on the availability of other animal products. So he was kind of amazed when he went there. I mean, this is like a guy from, you know, like Harvard basically, goes to, you know, the Arctic and finds all these people eating only meat, and he's like, these people are crazy.
And they were in perfect health.
And he was just like, this is such a paradox. So he ended up
with saturated fat from animals. They weren't having heart disease like crazy.
Yeah, yeah, very like mind-blowing. Perfect dental health, no cavities like whatsoever. So he became very interested in this topic, and when he came back to the States, he was like, all right, like, this works, but we don't really know why it works or how. So he decided to be part of this experiment where he would live on only meat for a whole year, and he recruited one of the people on his expeditions named Anderson, who had also been doing the carnivore diet, like, in the Arctic, and knew that, you know, it wouldn't kill him, because, like, how could you find someone who had actually agreed to doing this? So all the doctors and nutritionists at this hospital were, like, pretty certain he was lying when he told them, like, yeah, he only lived on meat, and they were sure he would die. And this was in the 1920s, so he already had, like, 40 years of vegetarian influence from, like, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and,
Oh, yeah, we've done a whole podcast on them. That story's crazy on itself.
Right, so, like, I think the vegetarian ideas had already kind of taken over, like, 100 years ago, and everyone kind of assumed that, you know, the more plants you ate, the more healthy you were. And so he goes on this ward, and they watch him for 3 months very carefully. They don't let him eat anything without a supervisor, and he only eats meat. And he quickly, like, adapts, enters nutritional ketosis, and stays there for the whole year. I think after 3 months, they realize, like, there's no point, like, watching him every day because he's very much, like, dedicated to it. So they, like, allow him to leave the hospital, and he would, like, travel around New York City and go and get, like, fat mutton chops and steaks and ribeyes and whatnot, wherever, you're, you know, at whatever restaurant he was at. And, yeah, so he did this entire year, and then at the end of the year, the doctors, like, re-looked at him again, and they were like, wow, you're actually in perfect health. And they published, like, 3 or 4 studies on it, on him and Anderson, and said, yeah, there's actually nothing remarkable about this. Like,
yeah, it's, like, really boring.
Do you know what he was eating?
Yeah, like, lamb and beef, mostly. Some fish, sometimes brains, sometimes chicken, but pretty much a typical carnivore diet as we think of it today.
So it was mostly the fatty cuts of meat. He wasn't doing some, like, low fat, high protein, like a bunch of chicken breasts. It was a lot of fatter cuts of steak, ground beef, that type of thing.
Right. So actually, it's funny you bring that up. The first week of his experiment, the scientists and doctors put him on a high protein diet, and he actually got pretty sick and developed diarrhea and had what is called rabbit starvation. So if you eat too high protein and you don't have enough fat to go with the protein, you, like, induce an illness, basically, and you become, like, hungry for fat. And so you need, like, a certain ratio of fat to protein, and they basically started him off on the wrong foot by having too high protein. They would give him very lean cuts of beef, and it didn't have enough fat for him, and his body was like, we need energy, we need these,
yeah, the essential fatty acids, all that. Yeah,
do you know what percentage they had him at? Was it like 50-50, like 70-30 protein to fat?
Yeah, I think it was basically they cut as much fat as they could out of the diet. So
yeah, I think they gave him lean cuts of meat, and then any visible fat they cut off.
So yeah, they were setting him up for failure.
They were, like, setting him up for failure. Because
they've noticed rabbit starvation. Like, that's been observed, like, back in Lewis and Clark era. I think even before that, like, the first North American explorers.
Yeah, he was kind of agitated at them. That, like, I knew this would happen, and you guys still forced me to do it. So after a week or so of being sick, they allowed him to have more fat in the diet, and then he instantly got better. So, yeah, this study was, like, published in 1929. It made a little bit of couple airwaves, but it never really seemed to, like, take off. And then he wrote, like, My Life in the Arctic, I think in 19, actually, it might have been before that. He wrote another book called Cancer, like a Disease of Civilization. And then he published Not by Bread Alone in, like, the 1940s. And that, like, was a overview of his time in the Arctic and everything he had learned there, and then also like the study itself and how he got through it, kind of as like, here's the scientific proof, right?
Yeah. He was like us, like all three of us now, we stumbled onto this diet and we realized, oh shit, there's something to it. And he was so inspired. He was like studying me. He was writing books. He was trying to get the message out there. And for whatever reason, it never really caught on. And you hear today a big argument for the carnivore diet is it hasn't been studied. But like, I want to see a 1-year random control study for like a carb-based diet. That didn't happen before we like recommended that with the dietary guidelines.
Oh, it's never going to happen. There's no money to be made. Not enough money to be made off of that.
Yeah, that's a sad truth. Have you guys read Nina Teicholz's book, The Big Fat Surprise?
Yeah, I have.
That goes through much of the history and how the moneyed interest kind of got super big in the 50s. Procter & Gamble was like a vegetable seed oil manufacturer, and they put down money for the American Heart Association. And then Ansel Keys came along and...
Fuck that guy, by the way. Yes.
Yeah, we had a funny, Twitter poll the other day, and someone was like, who's killed more people, like Hitler, Stalin, or Ansel Keys? And, like, everyone was voting for Ansel Keys. And it's like, all right, maybe he wasn't as evil as Hitler and Stalin, but, yeah, that kind of advice really just destroyed the population, I think.
Oh, it really did. We've had that conversation ourselves. Like, he is responsible. Like, he might not be an evil guy, we don't know him, but he's responsible for a lot of deaths.
Yeah, I mean, he knew his information was flawed, and he just pushed it upon everybody anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if he really knew it was flawed. I think years later, he kind of went back on it and said, yeah, I was probably wrong. And he would eat meat himself in saturated fat, and he lived into his 90s. He only died like 10 years ago or so.
He was like very selective with like the information that he published and what he didn't.
Right, yeah. He published a 7-nation study, right? And he like looked at 22 countries and found like their rates of saturated fat intake in various like small populations. And then only picked the ones that fit his hypothesis. And it made it seem like there is a very clear linear relationship between the amount of saturated fat in your diet and heart disease. And people bought it. But there was like a great deal of scientific debate back then. And Ansel Keys didn't like win the day easily. Like he had to fight for his ideas. And he didn't really fight them, like, scientifically. He just, like, called the other people names.
Yeah, he was a bully.
That's what it sounds like. Was he just louder than everybody else?
Yeah. I read John Yudkin's book recently named...
Pure White and Deadly?
Pure White and Deadly, right. And that guy was brilliant. Man, he did all sorts of studies on sugar and... really basically nailed like the hypothesis really well, and but Keyes won the day and basically called Yudkin a fraud and ended up being like the big American in the room. Yudkin was from England and ended up getting like industry support and dietary guidelines to follow him. Yeah. That was history.
I know. Actually, doing a lot of this research, one thing I find is I hate Ansel Keys. And the second thing I find is I feel real bad for John Yudkin. He seemed like such a good guy, and he was too nice for his own good. He pretty much got pummeled like through the media and all at these like conventions, and I feel bad for that guy.
Well, we're still seeing stuff like that happen today. What's the South African doctor?
Noakes.
Oh, Noakes, yeah.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. Noakes. Nina Teicholz had a big campaign trying to get him his license back. Did he get his license back yet? I think there's been some progress with that.
Oh, you're thinking about Gary Fetke from Australia. Well,
didn't both of them lose their license?
Well, Tim Noakes isn't a doctor. He's like a researcher and a professor. But like Tim Noakes was giving dietary advice on Twitter, and then like the Dietitians Association in South Africa called him in front of the board of health basically and said, like, we need to take this guy's professorship away and ban all of his advice because it goes against the status quo. And Tim Noakes fought back and said, actually the scientific evidence agrees with me and I'll prove it in court. And he got a great legal team that actually believed in like the low carb message. And he had a journalist, Marika Saboros, to be there at every meeting in the courtroom. And over 4 years, they presented like all this information to the entire courtroom. And at the end, he was found like not guilty. But it was a huge win. I really liked Tim Noakes. He did a Ask Me Anything at our subreddit, Keto Science, like exactly a year ago. I've been trying to do more and more with those, with, you know, various leaders in the low-carb field.
Oh, yeah, and I heard a funny story about that whole, like, trial. I heard Tim Noakes notice the prosecuting lawyer was losing weight, and then, like, right. throughout the years, and then he found out at the end of the trial that the lawyer that was prosecuting him went on a low-carb diet and lost weight and, like, thanked him at the end of it.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy. And he had to go, it took him 4 years to prove that low carb is safe. That's ridiculous.
Wait, the evidence was just Sandy like feet away from the
Yeah,
couch.
Like look at the dude yelling at me. Yeah.
It wasn't just like they were presenting every day. Like the Dietitians Association pushed it back the date over and over because they wanted to publish this review called the NAUD review, NAUDE, I think. And that was supposed to be like the smoking gun that was going to destroy low carb. But as soon as it got published, Tim Noakes tore it apart and was like, yeah, this isn't science at all. But like, I think the Dietitians Association was like, it bit off like a bigger bite than it could really chew. And it ended up being, I think, a really positive win for the low carb movement because, yeah, they were basically just basing their beliefs off of the status quo, like what was apparently known. And then Tim Noakes comes along with all this science and like destroys their case. And I think it's going to be a great blueprint for, you know, further litigation in the future. Like we've been on the defensive side. How long until we can become go on the offense, you know?
Yeah, that's a great point. Because if we really wanted to prove our case, we could. You know, like, we know what's going on. They just think they know. Once you look into the science behind the benefits of vegetables and the benefits of heart-healthy grains, you realize how shaky that foundation is.
Yeah, it really is. And I don't know. I don't know what the next country is going to be to have one of these fights. But I think a lot of doctors have been scared for, like, the last 10 years to even talk about low-carb to their patients because you bring it up and it's like, oh, you're going to eat more saturated fat and cholesterol. You're clearly going to die sooner. Like, or, you know, like if they're going to get blamed if someone has a heart attack.
Yeah, it becomes a weird like insurance thing. Like if they'll lose their license, that's their livelihood. That's what they went to school for 10 years for. So I kind of get it why doctors have to be that way. But it still doesn't make it less frustrating.
Yeah, I've really become like an advocate for doctors that push low carb, and I really hope to, you know, make other doctors question their beliefs and say, like, maybe fruit and vegetables aren't necessary, maybe grains aren't good for us, maybe sugar is more than just empty calories. Doctors, you know, they're taught for 10 hours of nutrition in their course, and then they become a doctor, they're super busy all the time, they don't have time to review all this evidence. And then over time, they get sick themselves, and they become fat and diabetic, and they're, like, telling their fat and diabetic patients, like, oh, you need to go on calorie-restricted diets and, you know, eat more healthy whole grains, and they're trying to do it themselves, and they're failing. So
If you think about a doctor failing a diet, by the way, what are doctors? They're smart. They're dedicated. It takes a lot of hard work to get through med school. And even they can't stick to this diet. Like, if anyone can't stick to that diet, doctors should be able to, you know?
Well, if you train a smart person in the wrong thing, they become an expert at doing the wrong thing.
Right. You guys know of Dr. Tro Kaligian?
Yeah, he's, I know about him through Twitter. He has a clinic in New York, right?
Yeah, he's opening one in North New Jersey.
Okay.
He was like 350 pounds. And his wife was like, are you going to be around for our kids like in 10 years? And he's like, good point. Maybe I should research this. And he went back through all the medical literature and was like, oh my gosh, there's so much evidence that low carb diets will help. And he was like all about, how do I like remove my hunger? Because the hunger made him overeat carbs, and then he would stay fat and get fatter. And he realized like, oh, if I just eat high fat, high protein meals, I'm actually going to be satiated and I don't need to eat all the time. And he lost 150 pounds and now he's like one of low carbs, like biggest success stories, you know?
All right. His story is really inspiring.
Well, it really doesn't make sense. If you're that overweight, you shouldn't be hungry. Like, you have so much stored energy on your body. Like, there's no reason for you to be hungry, except that your just metabolism's deranged from just eating the wrong foods all the time.
Right. And there's also Dr. Ken Berry, who's lost some weight, and he's now like a carnivore doctor. He's actually doing the carnivore diet and recommending it as like a good option to his patients. I run a Facebook group called World Carnivore Tribe. It was started by Sean Baker a year ago. Right now we're at 26,500 people. We've had a huge amount of growth over the last year. But yeah, like anytime Dr. Berry has a live stream and he has a bunch of like older people in there, you know, he'll talk about keto and carnivore. And then I'll, in the comments, I'll be like, hey guys, come join World Carnivore Tribe. And then I'll get like 20 or 40 or 50 requests to join. It's just nice to have doctors like now saying this stuff out loud. And people are like, wow, like I can actually trust this.
Oh yeah, it's true. I mean, but being carnivore, we still kind of are on the fringe. Even in the keto world, a lot of people look at us like we're crazy to this day.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that will change, but, well, I think it is changing. I think the thing I like the most about carnivore is it makes you really question your assumptions, right? Like, if you think fruits and vegetables are absolutely necessary, and you don't even have to get into carbs and sugar and, you know, refined junk food and all that, but if people are actually, like, improving their health by removing these things, like, what kind of health was actually coming out of them in the first place?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a very good point. And everybody that I know that's done a carnivore diet and did it the right way has loved it. I haven't heard anybody, like, do it the right way, you know, have a lot of fat with their protein, and then come out of it being like, you know what, I felt horrible on it. Everybody makes so many improvements. They usually lose some weight, better appetite control, and lots more energy.
Yeah, and then, like, so, like, keto has done really well for, like, diabetes and, like, metabolic health kind of things. But it doesn't really tackle autoimmune diseases that well. And it doesn't seem to help as well with, like, digestive issues. Clearly, sugar is pretty bad for your digestive system. And Yudkin talked a lot about that in his book. But actually removing plants altogether seems to help people who have these like horrible IBS, IBD, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, all these like diseases. Apparently 7-10% of people like worldwide have these digestive issues. And I'm like, well, what is it, just the junk food, or is it like all of our increased consumption of plants and, you know, fruits and vegetables that might be causing these things? And at this stage, I'm not really sure. It's just, I'm trying to research these things as well and make new wiki pages on them. Really fascinates me. It seems like like 100 years ago, people ate mostly meat if they could afford it. Peasants would, you know, have to survive off grains or whatever was available. But for the most part, people like really liked their meat. Then this whole fruit and vegetable kind of propaganda entered the fray. And over the last 100 years, it's kind of, you know, changed everyone's minds. But I've still haven't found like amazing evidence. Most of the time, like if you read these studies, it's like, well, it's pretty clear people like cut out junk food and ate more fruits and vegetables instead. And that probably explains why they're slightly healthier than other people. But there's no studies of like full-blown 100% carnivores adding in plants into their diet and then gaining some kind of better health out of that.
Exactly, yeah.
We have that kind of study, like, I don't really think we can say, like, plants are healthy for us.
No, I don't think so either. And I think, yeah, going back to grains, there's so many people I talk to who say they love, like, oatmeal for breakfast. Like, that's their go-to meal. And I usually have a comeback, and it's not, like, politically correct, but I tell them that's slave food. I'm like, that wouldn't even be considered healthy 100 years ago. Like, that, eating, like, mush wasn't really food back in the day. Like, we would give that to you to stay, like, docile and weak.
It doesn't even right. taste good either.
No, you need to add a ton of like brown sugar to it and all
some
that stuff.
Some honey, a bunch of, yeah, some sort of sweetener to it to make it taste decent.
You know, I grew up in junk food cereal and I was always begging my mom to buy Lucky Charms. And you know, that marketing, all the sugar.
Yeah, I'm still anti-vegetable now. It's not even funny. I'm like Mr. Pro-Meat and I just don't think vegetables add any benefit. Because from a nutritional standpoint, you're going to get everything your body needs from meat. And you're going to get it in the most bioavailable form and in the right proportions that your body needs it. And I guess if you like broccoli, go ahead and eat it. But don't act like broccoli's adding something to the plan that steak's not already bringing to the plate.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, broccoli is like 84% fiber and water. And then there's like a couple like sulforaphanes that Rhonda Patrick's always talking about.
Oh, she loves those things. You know, she fooled me. I guess I shouldn't say that, but I bought that shit hard and heavy a few years back when she was first kind of talking about it.
This was like 5 years ago.
It was a while ago, yeah. And my ass was eating like raw broccoli every day. Like, oh, sulforaphane, I need this shit. And now, like, I think about that, so stupid. Like, I think it's called the hormetic effect of food, where it's like it's a little poison and your body bounces back.
Right.
How about I just stop poisoning myself? You know what I mean?
Right. Like, am I going to have some arsenic and cyanide?
Yeah, go sip gasoline.
Yeah, it's just like, why are people doing this?
Yeah.
Well, we're stressing out our bodies enough as is. There's so many other toxic things that we're breathing in and just exposed to. I don't think we really need to increase it from our food source that's already sprayed with glyphosate or whatever else.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we're all looking at, like, blue screens and, like, none of that shit's natural.
We're surrounded by a couple laptops, iPad, phones, producing all these EMFs. Like, that's not natural at all.
No.
I don't even know how I would prove that, like, plants add to your health these days, right? Like, you'd have to do, like, a study on 100% carnivores, add in certain plants, measure certain biomarkers over years, and then like maybe like all this increase in cancer isn't just related to sugar, but maybe this hormesis effect is also affecting us, or maybe it's causing autoimmune issues when you're really young. We have taste buds, right? And we find vegetables are very bitter when we're young. And then, like, over time, like, we eat them enough, and then we, like, come to like them. But what if that was, like, a way for our ancestors to know that, like, vegetables aren't actually that good for us?
Yeah, who's eating, like, the only reason I was eating, like, raw broccoli is because, like, we talked about having an iron will earlier. I'm that type of guy. If I think it's going to help me, if I think it's going to make me bigger or stronger or smarter, I'll do it. But it's not, trust me, I didn't like it. It's not like raw broccoli tastes good, you know?
No, not at all. I mean, the only vegetables I think actually taste good are like root ones, like potatoes, like sweet potato. Those taste good. But other than that, no other vegetable tastes good on its own. You have to add some butter, some ranch dressing, some sort of like fatty source. And it's the fat that's tasting good, not the vegetable itself.
I grew up liking broccoli because we would put balsamic vinegar on it. And it would like soak through, and then it had like that sweet balsamic taste.
Yeah, so the vegetable just turns into like a vessel for the flavor. You might as well just use a fucking spoon. You know what I mean? All right, so that's the end of part one. This podcast did run a little long, so we decided to break it up into two parts. So the conversation will continue next week, and it's great. I recommend you listen to it, learn more about the history and anatomy of why humans are designed to eat meat. But let's finish this podcast with a tip of the week. So Tom, what do you got?
All right, so everybody knows that our homes have many toxins in them. Like most of our furniture is sprayed with flame retardant. So that's very toxic in general. So the couch that we're sitting on all the time, the mattresses that we're sleeping on, the carpets that we're walking on all the time, those are full of toxins. And then also most of the cleaning products that we use have other toxins as well. So there's a couple.
It's all new to me.
Ways you can combat that. You can buy like an expensive air filter, but you're gonna have to replace the filters all the time. If you live in a place where it's like either really cold right now, which is everywhere in the United States, or if you live somewhere that gets really hot during summertime, we do, for example, it gets over 100 degrees for a couple months out of the year. We don't have a lot of airflow going on, so all those toxins are just staying in our house. So like a really good option to do this is you just buy a houseplant. So not only do they filter out many of the toxins, there's actually a buying guide that NASA provided that shows you what toxins they do. So you can buy two different plants that cover different toxins. So you got all your bases covered, put them in different rooms of your house, so they're help filtering out all these toxins. And then another advantage to that as well is if you're keeping your windows closed, that air in your house is gonna be stagnant. So you're not gonna have that much fresh oxygen. So plants and humans have a perfect symbiotic relationship. We exhale CO2, they inhale CO2. They exhale O2, we inhale O2. It's a perfect relationship. So just adding some plants to your life or into your environment takes care of both of those problems. So I know I personally don't have any plants right now. After doing the research for this tip of the week, I'm about to go on my way and buy two different plants on my way. And NASA's guide is really great. But if you do have some pets, like some cats and dogs, many plants are toxic to those. So you might want to check those out before you go and buy them. And then also do a little bit of research just to see, you know, if you're lazy and you don't want to water them all the time, you know, get a plant that's hard to kill. Snake plants are really hard to kill. Lily turf, those are hard to kill. Broadleaf, lady palms, those are harder to kill. They don't need that much water, don't need that much sunshine. So those are some good plants to go off of if you need a guide.
Yeah, that's a great tip. I'm actually going to take you up on that. I'm going to pick up some few plants myself and get some fresh O2 in here. All right, that's another episode in the books. Thank you for listening. You can find us at tntwellnessandnutrition.com. I recently redid most of the website, so it's website 2.0, so feel free to check it out. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that. So if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please reach out.
Yeah, and please rate and subscribe to our podcast. If you've already subscribed, unsubscribe, and then subscribe again. Boost our numbers a little bit. You can find us on Apple iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. Hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.